This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The advances made in the past decade or so in genetic testing have been astounding, and research in this area continues to go forward in labs and universities across the country. But there's another place genetic tests are starting to pop up: homes.
This new knowledge I was referring to about associations between genotypes and disease are relatively new, and to be honest, the literature can be kind of confusing.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the growth of in-home genetic testing and why this do-it-yourself trend may not always be a good idea. We'll also hear the story of a couple of veterans who are using training of the mind to leave the battles of war behind. And we'll spend an academic minute with a different type of therapist, a horse. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Over the past few years, there's been a dramatic increase in not only what we know about the genetic risk of disease, but also the ability to accurately measure an individual's genotype. Private companies are now attempting to capitalize on these advances by providing direct-to-consumer genetic testing that estimates the risk of disease for a customer given their genotype. Because these tests make claims about medical conditions, they've come under scrutiny by regulatory agencies. Dr. David Spencer, co-chief of the Laboratory and Genetic Medicine Department at Washington University School of Medicine, recently polled several leading researchers to determine whether these breakthroughs in genetic testing are helpful or harmful to doctors and patients. He wrote about his findings in the journal Clinical Chemistry, and we spoke recently. I asked Dr. Spencer about genetic testing.
Well, I mean, as the name implies, direct-to-consumer testing is testing that's marketed directly to and requested by consumers, as opposed to most genetic testing, which is ordered in the context of medical care by a physician, usually in response to a specific diagnosis. Direct-to-consumer testing is ordered by an individual and is not related to any particular condition. It's kind of analogous to a prescription medication that a physician orders for a patient, as opposed to, say, over-the-counter kind of vitamins that somebody can just pick up at the supermarket.
What do direct-to-consumer companies offer consumers that other medical labs can't provide?
Direct-to-consumer tests generally focus on risk of disease rather than offering a definitive diagnosis. Most genetic tests that doctors order in the hospital confirm a diagnosis, or once a diagnosis has been made, help the physician determine prognosis for that patient. The direct-to-consumer genetic tests generally focus on risks of having a disease, even if that disease isn't present at that moment. And disease risks are based on really relatively recent knowledge of how the genetic makeup of an individual at specific regions in the genome, called the patient's genotype at those positions in the genome, might confer either the increased or decreased risk of disease. And these diseases are typically common diseases that people are concerned about, like heart disease and diabetes and that sort of thing. And the patient, you know, may or may not have those diseases at the moment, but these genotypes can inform the risk of disease in the patients. And because the risks are conferred by these genotypes are really relatively weak compared to things like diet and exercise and family history, medical labs don't really perform the tests and physicians don't request them. And so the direct-to-consumer companies are trying to capitalize on this niche and offer them directly to consumers.
Do the tests require any involvement from a physician or the patient's healthcare provider?
No, generally not. Some of the companies do have mechanisms to kind of involve the patient's physician, but most of them, the consumer can request them just by on their own without any prescription or anything.
Well, just to follow up, then a physician is going to have some information available that they really didn't request. Are they going to do anything with it now that it's there?
Well, that's a good question. I bet, you know, most physicians are not prepared to handle this sort of information, mainly because this new knowledge I was referring to about associations between genotypes and disease are relatively new. And to be honest, the literature can be kind of confusing. Some studies suggest one risk and some suggest another. And so I bet many physicians don't know exactly what to do with this information. And, you know, my recommendation is if a physician is confronted with these questions is to kind of make the standard recommendations that apply to a lot of these common diseases about diet and lifestyle and that sort of thing. I mean, those effects are as large, if not larger, than the ones conferred by most of the disease risks that are claimed by these companies.
Okay, well, how are the tests performed? What sort of sample is usually required?
Most of these companies have you swab the cells off the inside of your cheek or deposit some saliva into a container and mail it off. And after that, the company extracts the DNA and applies it to a surface. And on that surface, there are spots where the different genotypes are interrogated. And depending on which of the genotypes light up with the patient's DNA, you can determine what genotype the patient has at these positions across the genome. And most of these assays measure somewhere between hundreds to thousands of genotypes, even up to hundreds of thousands of genotypes. And then from that information, they have a list of the risks that the genotypes may confer either individually or kind of as a collection, the risks that are conferred for various diseases. And then they issue a report based on that information.
Are the tests very accurate? And is the FDA involved in any of this?
The tests are not FDA approved, but medical tests don't necessarily have to be FDA approved in order to be used. So that's not really a necessity. As far as the accuracy goes, analytically, meaning the same patient provides a specimen and they do the same test, do they get the same answer? In that respect, they are very analytically accurate. Most of these platforms, the concordance is more than 98% looking across several hundred thousand genotypes. So they're very accurate analytically. However, as I alluded to earlier, the interpretations can be problematic. Which study is considered when determining the risk of a genotype? What collection of genotypes do you use to come up with kind of an aggregate risk? All those methods are a little more fuzzy, and it depends on what method you use and what literature you're reading, what study you consider when you are assigning a risk. And this is something that was pointed out by experts in the field, that how you arrive at a final risk determination is variable and can actually lead to different risk assessments at the end of the company's report. And this has been shown in studies where they sent the same sample to multiple companies and got different answers. So that part is not as accurate, but analytically they are very accurate.
Well, from some of your answers, I can tell this is generating some controversy. Tell us some of the controversies around genetic testing.
So recently, there's been a flurry of controversy because the FDA has felt like these companies may be making claims that are invalid, and so they are starting to intervene. So that's kind of been the nidus for some recent controversy. But it kind of occurs on a backdrop of how useful these tests are. As I mentioned, the risks that these genotypes confer are really pretty small. And for common diseases that are multifactorial and involve things like diet and lifestyle, these risks are really very small. Now, as we learn more, sometimes you can add up some genotypes and get to a risk that is meaningful. But in general, the risk is so small that the fact that these companies are asserting that they can predict your risk of heart disease or whatever is really dubious. So there's that aspect to it. And there's also this issue of different interpretations provided by different companies that's also sparked some controversy. If you send your saliva to two different companies and get two different answers, then how useful are these tests and how valid are the claims that they make? Finally, as I said earlier, the knowledge of these associations between genotype and disease risk are really pretty new. And I think there's a valid question of, do we know enough about these associations to say meaningful things? I think many of these associations that have been reproduced by multiple groups and multiple studies are real, but there doesn't mean they're not complicated and really needs more scrutiny before we can really confidently say what the risk association is.
Well, we've been hearing more about genome sequencing lately. Will this affect genetic testing services offered to consumers?
Yeah, I'm sure that it will. The cost of genome sequencing continues to go down on basically a monthly basis. That will make it possible for companies to not only provide genotypes, maybe a couple thousand or 100,000 genotypes across the genome to consumers, but indeed their entire 3 billion base pair genome. And that will certainly be technically possible and probably be marketed to consumers sometime in the near future. This will have several effects, and one of them is that not only will those companies be able to provide these low, kind of weak associations between variants and disease, but they could also identify serious mutations in the genome and in genes that could really confer disease on the patient or the patient's children. And I think, that's something that is definitely going to be possible in the near future.
Well, then let's talk about the future. Where do you see direct-to-consumer genetic testing maybe 5 years from now?
Well, in 5 years, we're going to learn a lot more about the genome, and in particular, what mutations seem to confer a serious disease, not just these associations, as I mentioned, what the mutations in what genes cause clinical disease. So as we know more about the genome, there more tests can be developed and more can be said once you do this widespread genotyping or genome sequencing. You know, it remains to be seen how far the FDA will go in regulating these sorts of tests. It is clear, though, that when we know more, these companies will be able to say more to consumers. And as it gets more clinically relevant, then I think it really makes sense for these tests to at least have some physician involvement to interpret the results for patients. Depends how far the FDA is going to go in regulating these sorts of tests.
Dr. David Spencer is the co-chief of the Laboratory and Genetic Medicine Department at Washington University School of Medicine. His article on genetic testing can be found in the journal Clinical Chemistry. Still to come, a couple of returning vets use mindfulness to cope with post-war issues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1258. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. If you went to a dictionary and looked up mindfulness, you'd get something like this: the intentional, accepting, and non-judgmental focus of one's attention on the emotions, thoughts, and sensations occurring in the present moment. For Nathan and Leslie Keith, it means helping them fight an inner struggle in their minds that began half a world away. Judy Silber from the program Cross Currents has their story.
In many ways, Nathan and Leslie Keith are well-adjusted, regular people.
My name is Leslie Keith. I was in the Navy from April 1999 to April 2010, total of 11 years.
My name is Nathan Keith. I joined the Navy in 1996, February, and I got out approximately 16 years later.
They're both in their early 40s, friendly, and they obviously care a lot about one another. Nathan Keith speaks with pride about the day he met Leslie on a military base in Kuwait. They're now married, and they both study and work at the same time. On the surface, they lead stable lives. But dig a little deeper, and you'll find that the Keiths are in the middle of a serious struggle. It started in 2006, just after they came back from Kuwait.
I think that we both came back a little not as patient with other people. And because we came from such a traumatic place, from such a tense environment.
Neither Leslie nor Nathan saw combat, but in Kuwait, they felt what was happening in Iraq. Leslie screened soldiers for PTSD and plucked shrapnel from the wounded. Her husband worked as a customs and border patrol guard, and some of the convoy drivers he befriended disappeared. Initially, to cope, they drank a lot. Like on a week-long cruise they took a few months after they got back.
We went on this cruise and we ended up spending, what was it, almost $2,000?
Yeah.
Just in alcohol.
I think that we were both stressed out. I don't know if you'd call it PTSD per se, but we just drank for that comfort and to help us calm down, because you are so hypervigilant when you come back to the States and it takes a long time to just really settle down and just be able to relax.
Right now, the Keiths are not officially diagnosed with PTSD, but they both suffer from anxiety, and Leslie came back sick from Kuwait. She couldn't sleep well or remember simple things, like whether she'd eaten or taken a shower. Eventually, she was diagnosed with a parathyroid disorder, possibly caused by her time overseas. The Keiths left the Navy in 2010. That was especially tough on Nathan. They both found help at the VA, but still felt isolated and depressed. Then a VA counselor suggested they try something different, a Zen meditation retreat, just for veterans.
We always honor everybody's bravery when you come for the first time to some event, when you have no idea what you're walking into, and now you come.
Inside a large yurt, a meditation teacher speaks to a group of 25 veterans, including the Keiths. They're at Green Gulch Farm, a retreat center in Marin, right off Highway 1. It's quiet here, peaceful. Leslie is excited for the one-day workshop. Nathan, not so much.
That's just me nowadays. I was looking for literally any reason to not go. And then when we got up, I was just like, okay, fine, I'll go. I'll go.
So we're just going to start off with introductions.
The teacher is Lee Lesser, and she's the executive director of Honoring the Path of the Warrior, or HPW. It's the nonprofit that organized this gathering.
Where you served, when you served.
Hi, my name is Matt Cruz. I served from 97 to 2003 in the Army. I was infantry.
Hey everybody, I'm Sam. I was in the Army. I did 7 years. I was a mechanic and a combat medic. I was medevaced out of Iraq. Ended up in Germany.
My name is Jesse. I was an Army military police slash medic, and I served from 2002 to 2008. I went to 2 tours in Iraq. My second tour, I received a traumatic brain injury, which in turn made me have a stroke. I cannot use my left
side. Some of the vets have been coming to HPW for years. Others, like the Keiths, are here for the first time. Despite his initial reluctance, Nathan Keith opened right up.
Morning, everybody. I'm Nathan Keith. I was stationed on the Iraq-Kuwait border as a Navy Customs and Border Patrol agent, as a reservist. I've met a lot of great people. I've lost some really great friends. To have the military say that you're a great person as long as you're deployed, but when you get back to the States, we don't need you. And that's what happened.
It's an intense opening to the day. After introductions, Lee Lesser passes around fist-sized sandbags and tells the veterans to also grab a meditation cushion. When she rings a bell, she tells them to pair up and toss the objects back and forth as fast as they can.
You ever play the game Hot Potato when you were kids? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like a hot potato, you don't want to keep it in your hand. And are you holding your breath, or is your breath moving freely?
Lesser isn't a vet herself. She's a longtime student of Zen Buddhism. When the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, she was reminded of the Vietnam War and how hard it was for soldiers when they came home. This time around, she wanted to help.
Somehow it just pulled at me. I wanted to do something. And what I felt like I could offer is the practice of sensory awareness, which is the practice I've relied on since I was 19 years old.
Pausing and just noticing what aliveness you feel in your body now.
It's being in your body, being with your breath, being with our natural sensations as an anchor. And I felt that if veterans would be interested, this would be useful.
At the first event 7 years ago, the focus was more on sitting meditation. But the vets couldn't sit still. So Lesser and her co-founder decided to include moving meditations with activities like hiking, rock climbing, or whitewater rafting, all the while tuning into body and breath. Today at Green Gulch, the group gets quieter as the day passes, as if the vets are becoming more at ease. After lunch, the group walks to a garden. They stop occasionally when a bell rings, just to listen. They then gather around a tree where HPW co-founder Chris Fortin points to chamomile growing in the grass.
You know about chamomile? It's calming.
I would even suggest that you might want to just right now lay down in a patch of chamomile.
Doing things that not only calm the mind, but also help calm the body can be really helpful. And And so we are seeing a lot more of that.
That's Jeff Stadler. He's a therapist with the VA in Menlo Park. He says mindfulness exercises can be helpful for veterans with PTSD or for those who just come home anxious and hypervigilant. The VA itself is starting to use similar practices.
I suspect that in the future that we're going to be seeing a lot more of it, and it's going to become maybe a much more integrated part and more readily offered type of approach than it is right now.
But Stadler says HPW's approach is unique in that it combines meditation with community and nature.
They create a very safe environment, and they make it one in which people feel comfortable to be open with others and to be able to express some of the things that are challenges for them.
Back in the yurt, it's towards the end of the day, and Lee Lesser asks the veterans to draw something that gives them strength. Nathan Keith draws an infinity symbol.
We could go anywhere and do anything, but we forget that. Whitewater rafting, going into the military, becoming an Eagle Scout, coming to this thing today, you can do this.
Leslie Keith is also feeling more hopeful after the retreat.
I felt like I was understood. I felt like somebody had empathy for me. That's what I really appreciated, and that's what I've always wanted. I just want people to have empathy for me.
A few weeks later, the Keiths are thinking about the kinds of changes they want to make in their lives. At this point, it's nothing too ambitious. Clean the house, get out into nature, go for walks. They also want to attend another HPW event. This time, Nathan says he won't resist. For Cross Currents, I'm Judy Silber.
Mindfulness can be great therapy, but sometimes you just need a horse. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Equine therapy presents a unique approach to mental health treatment. Erica Berg, associate professor of animal science at North Dakota State University, is studying this non-traditional form of psychotherapy.
Teens in residential child care facilities often have strong antagonism towards social norms and lack work and study skills. Many have difficulty communicating and use violence to cope. These behaviors are typically the result of abuse or neglect, and traditional therapies often have limited long-term success. Finding therapies that work is imperative because eventually these youth must function in society. Equine-assisted psychotherapy is a non-traditional therapy that engages individuals with horses in a safe environment. During equine-assisted psychotherapy sessions, the mental health professional and equine specialist design exercises with the horse that allow the client to problem solve. Because a horse's survival depends on reading their surroundings, they are keyed into the body language of other living beings, including people. If you walk up to a horse aggressively, chances are they won't stick around. From experiences like this, individuals can draw parallels about how they approach people in their life and figure out more positive ways of interacting. We are collaborating with a residential child care facility to compare 12 weeks of traditional talk therapy to 12 weeks of equine-assisted psychotherapy in adolescents identified as having problematic behaviors such as aggression, lying, and defiance. These youth are at greater risk for antisocial behaviors later in life. Measures include degree of psychopathology, empathy, and self-concept. Preliminary evidence indicates the problematic behaviors in the equine-assisted therapy group normalized in all areas. For those in 12 weeks of traditional talk therapy, results were less dramatic. Behaviors did not return to normal in all areas. When the study is completed, we hope the results can be used to support the effectiveness of equine therapy to healthcare providers that do not currently cover it. Equine-assisted therapy can be expensive due to the costs of maintaining, housing, and feeding the horses, and those costs need to be justified. Future studies will include long-term assessments.
That was Erica Berg of North Dakota State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.